At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Okay, Liz, Faraj Badenoch, what gifts would they give each other?
I think she'd give Faraj a sandwich.
A moist sandwich.
A moist sandwich.
Moist sandwich.
Pre-digested.
Okay, Professor Tim.
Oh.
Assad Putin.
I was going to say a knife in the back, but given the fact that one of them is dead, I suppose advice might be the best thing. Advice from beyond the grave.
Yeah.
Graham.
Yes.
Donald Trump, Boris Johnson.
Oh.
What present that Donald Trump should give Boris Johnson?
Or Boris to Trump, you can choose.
Syphilis.
I think we already had it.
Welcome everyone to the Sunday Roast, and we have some amazing co-hosts. We have no guests this week, we have co-hosts. Our first co-host, Graham, can you please introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Graham Hughes, the world's most travelled Scouser, and I'm currently the host of the Politics Social channel here on YouTube. Check that out.
And Professor Tim, can you please introduce yourself?
Oh, I never really know what I am, but I do have my own channel called Professor Tim, I think, or something like that, some variation on that. And I talk about politics. My passion is animation and goat herding and a little bit of religion thrown in. I think humour should be mixed with serious thought, not necessarily giving the audience a clue which is which.
I've got to be honest, that's part of the ethos of the Sunday Roast. It's like, we are going to give out a lot of facts, but we want to make it a bit funny because the world is ridiculous at the moment. And my other co-host, Liz, can you please introduce yourself?
Hello, I am Liz Webster, and I am the founder of Save British Farming. And I also have a channel, Liz Webster, Save British Farming. And I spend most of my time talking about farming, food, Brexit, and politics, and... having some fun as well.
So, I'm Alex, also known as Political X. I am a historian, YouTuber. We're going to be talking today about healthcare. I mean, there's so many topics we could have talked about. There's the collapse in Syria. There is Farage, there's Badenoch, and farming. But I think we're going to go with private healthcare today. Or the privatization of it and the NHS, especially with what's taking place over in the United States with Luigi, and apologies to everyone who's Italian, Manglioni, who shot the CEO of United Healthcare. And part of the theory behind it, although it's not conclusive and it's all alleged at the moment, there's my caveat to protect us from being sued, is the fact that he seemed to have chronic illness and he was in such pain, and his parents are suggesting that he might have been deluded enough, if he did the crime, to have lost his mind and ended up taking out the CEO of United Healthcare. So in light of that, I thought it'd be an interesting chat to have about the NHS and private healthcare and what's been taking place in the US and in the UK, and sort of overlap the two topics together. So some people are calling him a Robin Hood. Others are calling him an outright criminal. Have you got any thoughts, Graham?
Well, I mean, first off, I mean, the people who were condemning this act of violence were the exact same people who thought it was okay that, and funny, they were making jokes about the fact that Paul Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's husband, was attacked by a hammer. Those exact same people are ones now freaking out, saying, no, this is a disgraceful act of violence. So, you know, they're also the same people who defended what happened on January the 6th in 2021, when 9 people died as a result of that. 150 police officers were injured. $3 million worth of damage done to the Capitol building. That seemed all right. They thought that was okay. That was a nice day trip for this lot. So it's a little bit hypocritical of them to turn around now and say this was a bad thing that happened. And from my point of view, I think, you know, no, every life is precious. I don't want to see anyone die. However, having said that, this CEO of this particular healthcare company, it looks like he's responsible for a lot of deaths. So is this like a trolley car problem? Like a healthcare company is now going to process people's claims quicker? Because what's happened as a result of this incident, of this killing, is that you've had this outpouring of hundreds, perhaps thousands of stories from Americans who were denied healthcare or delayed healthcare while the insurance companies sorted themselves out. It's come out that the insurance company that this guy worked for used AI to process people's claims, AI that was 90% wrong, a 90% error rate. And over 600,000 Americans go bankrupt every year because of medical costs. And the way they do it is infuriating. And I hadn't really dug down into this until this incident happened. But there are cases where, for instance, Alex, if heaven forfend, you get hit by a car, right? And you're unconscious, you're bleeding on the pavement, right? They pick you up and put you in an ambulance and they'll take you to the nearest hospital, right? With me so far? Mm-hmm. It turns out that that hospital is what they call out of coverage or something, like it's a mobile phone signal for that particular healthcare provider that you pay a lot of money to each month. And as a result of that, when you regain consciousness, you have to pay for all of your healthcare bills. And these healthcare bills go into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. There was another story I heard about someone's mother who needed to go in for an MRI on her hip urgently because of the pain that she was having and a very worrying x-ray. And the healthcare company, which was the same healthcare company, by the way, said, no, we're not going to let her have an MRI. If she wants one, she'll have to pay for it herself. The doctor argued against this, and eventually it got resolved. Took 5 weeks. In that 5 weeks, before she got the MRI, the cancer, because it was cancer she had in her hip, spread to a point where it was inoperable. So if she'd had the MRI when the doctor had asked for it 5 weeks earlier, she might have survived. 5 weeks later, she was definitely dead. And or going to die. And then the last story I saw was just unbelievable. It's like to do with filling out forms. And there was someone who had lost both their legs. And it was an application for a wheelchair. This insurance company said, no, you're going to have to pay for your own wheelchair. Why? Because the doctor didn't explain when filling out the form why the person with no legs needed a wheelchair. And I'm like, oh my God, this can't happen here. And Farage wants this. This is the healthcare system that Nigel Farage wants in this country. And that is shocking, terrifying, and should be shouted from the rooftops, because I don't think a lot of the people who take the NHS for granted, vote for reform, I don't think they understand what they'll be facing. I mean, he'll be fine. Farage will be fine. You know, he's rich, he's posh. He goes out hunting in a, you know, jacket. He'll be okay. He's got a bank account with Coutts. And if he can't have a bank account with Coutts, it'll be all over the front pages of all the newspapers. Oh my God, how can this guy not have a posh bank account at Coutts? So, you know, my heart bleeds for him. But yeah, he'll be fine in a insurance-based model. But the rest of us, we're going to be in so much trouble, because how much would you pay to save your loved ones? Mm. That's the equation that these health companies make. How much would you pay?
Well, yes, I mean, I agree. I thought I wasn't going to agree with very much of what you said, Graham. But I agree with almost everything you said. The beginning, I think you're. I think one's got to be really careful about the idea of somebody killing somebody else. I think there are there might be some hypocrisy there, but there are also absolute standards, and one of the absolute standards is we don't kill people, and we have to make that really clear.
Yeah.
But secondly, the assumption that. That should we go for an insurance-based system, a wholly insurance-based system, we're going to be better off is absurd. And you know, I entirely agree with you there. But we've already got an insurance-based system and it doesn't work. The insurance-based system that we've got is dependent on the NHS. The NHS doesn't work, and the insurance which people might pay to try and get a little bit more control doesn't work either. And I've looked into this quite vigorously, because I've been caught out twice now and almost killed twice in hospitals because I have I'm on the haemophilia scale, and each time I go into a hospital for serious operations like what is it, an appendix or cancer, they either delay so much that the appendix burst, or they didn't take me seriously when I told them that they should be talking to another hospital which treats my haemophilia, and they should give me X, Y, and Z drugs, which they don't. They give me something off the shelf, and a week later, everything opens up. The surgery they've done collapses, and I'm bleeding on the floor like the home looks like an abattoir. And then nine hours later, when the ambulance finally comes, I mean, you know, this is the absurdity of our system. And even with private healthcare, I couldn't be treated because I have a pre-existing condition.
Yes.
Or because, and as I explained, that pre-existing condition is never going to change. That pre-existing condition was something I was born with. And then, you know, oh, it's too complicated for a private healthcare to deal with. So this is the problem we're up against, that the bureaucracy of managing health in Britain is beyond healthcare, and the bureaucrats have got in the way of the system, so that actually the bureaucrats make medical decisions, which mean we get the wrong treatment. And either I'm that Mr. Nasty. I've actually got the paperwork now, which admits that the hospital made stupid decisions and didn't consult the other hospital. Wow. What am I going to do? Sue the NHS? Of course I'm not. It's barely able to crawl around the floor. But I don't trust the NHS. I can't trust the NHS because it's twice almost killed me.
I had a weird experience with my dad. I'll bring you in, Liz, next, where he had a heart attack. We took him into hospital. This is 10 years ago. And we left him there. It was early evening. We thought he was going to get treated and looked after. We came back the next morning and he was still in the corridor, to which we then sort of spoke to the nurses and they denied it. They like denied it to our face, even though we were there. He then told me, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, he disconnected himself from all the heart monitors and went to the loo. The alarms came on and he came back and reconnected himself and no one turned up, which is wild.
We
wrote to our MP, who coincidentally also happened to be a doctor, and he backed the NHS and said we made it up, which I thought was wild. And that's where you get that level of distrust coming in with the NHS. The opposite side is I've had these amazing experiences for friends, family, myself, with other major operations that I've had, which makes me go, I fully trust it. And I think the bureaucracy thing is an interesting one. I think it's more of a human thing, because I wouldn't trust I trust the insurance companies less. There's no two ways about it, like a lot less, because I'm just going, your whole thing is a profit margin. And interestingly, we brought up health. Do you know what Healthcare United was making in profit in 2014? Would anyone like to guess?
More than Exxon Mobil.
Ooh, someone's done their research.
So wow.
$4 billion in profit. Do you know what there is today? So 10 years later, $22 billion. You're going, geez.
Out of human suffering and being the middlemen. They're not treating anyone. They're literally taking money off people and then depositing it where they want it to be deposited. Most of which seems to go towards the yachts of the CEOs and their cocaine, I guess. I don't know which people do. But when we talk about the NHS, I mean, it is, you know, a highly emotive subject. And obviously, Tim, you've had terrible experiences. What I would say to you is, when you think about, you know, when you say suing the NHS, or I would say claiming compensation, it's not the NHS will pay that. It's an insurance company, because the NHS is insured against malpractice. So I would really recommend, if it's disrupted your life, you know, go in for it.
Can I bring Liz in, and I'll bring you back in, Tim? Just because
please bring me back in after this. Yes, absolutely.
I promise I will.
I think, rather than, you know, because we can all share anecdotal evidence all night, I think what we have to look at is, why is this happening? And I really noticed that really since 2010, there's been a war on universalism, which came in after the war. And that post-war pact was to do with everybody actually coming together and sharing and making life better for everybody. And I can bring in farming into this as well, because that is part of it. And I think that the ideology behind it is very evil. It is a Malthusian type of psychology thing, that there's too many people. And interestingly, I had a meeting with Henry Dimbleby, who was in charge of the food plan, which of course is linked to health and the national health system. And I asked him why he'd take the food plan on with Brexit, because he's very good friends with Michael Gove, and they...
Could you explain what the food plan is to our viewers?
So after Brexit happened, the Conservative government at the time appointed Henry Dimbleby. This was under May, I think it started, and then it continued under Boris Johnson, as the sort of food czar. Now, Henry Dimbleby is a journalist, and he happened to start a fast food chain of supposed healthy food. I mean, I've been there once. I wouldn't say it was healthy food, it's fast food. And he's very, very good friends with Michael Gove, and they spent the referendum night together. And I knew this because I'd read a Guardian article by Jay Rayner, who was livid that he'd been appointed as the food czar to write the food plan. So I asked Henry why he would take this job on, given that he's a supporter of Brexit, and Brexit means throwing our food under the Brexit bus. And I expected him to waffle a bit, but he just looked at me and he said, "Oh, Liz, that's really easy." He said, "Well, because post-war policy has led to over-intensification and overpopulation." And at that point, I became very, very angry with him and just said, "No, we're not overpopulated, Henry. There was a baby boom after the war. Then we invented the pill. And now we've actually got a problem with the birth rate being so low, which is why we need immigration." Yeah. And so we had a massive row about it. But I listened to what Nigel Farage says. A, he's obsessed with Hitler and has been for some time. At the base of Nazism is Malthusian and eugenic. And that's what I see. And if you're rich and you believe in that sort of only the rich and the strong should survive, then you would go for a private health system. And what I would say about this murder, because it is a murder, is that the good thing about it is that the very wealthy people behind these corporations, who too tend to lose touch, it's good for them to feel the heat, the same as perhaps with the French Revolution or with the Russian Revolution, because ultimately we are all human and we all have the same vulnerabilities. And yes, some people are more vulnerable than others. But the reason I have been so vehemently against Brexit is because I am an absolute staunch believer in universalism. It is the only way to have a safe society and as equal as possible, and to have empathy and a good social community. It is the most successful system in the world so far. Nothing has beaten it. And the fact that we are being pushed towards a tsunami of the American system, which is disgusting food, which makes you sick, and then a very expensive private healthcare system, which then feeds off you because you've eaten all of that shit food, it terrifies me. And I don't want to live in a country which is like that. And I still hope that we'll be able to turn it around. I hoped that the Labour government would agree with me, but it seems that I was wrong. And Keir Starmer, I don't believe, is somebody that believes in universalism, or if he did, he's been bought to believe in the polar opposite of that. But I hope the Labour Party itself begins to fight and move against this, because it's a very nasty place, America. I don't mind visiting there, but they're not my values. I feel European, and that I don't want to have that sort of system.
I would turn around and say I feel it's more of people within government and positions of power than it is the average American. The average American I've gotten on very well with, and I don't feel that their values reflect. No, I mean, obviously, you know,
half of them voted for a rapist, mate. Half of them voted for an adjudicated rapist.
70 million did.
Oh, okay. Half the voters voted.
Yeah. So there's a caveat.
So it's only literally the population of the UK that voted for
the ones that I interacted with.
Yeah,
I was making anecdotes.
The nice ones.
There's obviously I'm going to always try and put that caveat in. But there's obviously 70 million for whatever reason decided that Trump was the best way in. I said, Professor Tim, you would come in next.
Oh, no. I just wanted to pick you up, first of all, on your comment that the NHS has been run down by the Conservatives. But the rundown started under Blair. And I think one has to recognise that. As for the universalism, I entirely agree with you. And I entirely agree that it's been slipping, certainly since the 70s. But I think universalism, it's not a political creed. It's a moral creed.
Yeah.
We are measured by the way that we treat the poorest in our society, and that's the principle on which the whole business of taking in refugees is based. And if that's not acceptable to us or to Europe or to America, then we need to reform the 1951 Refugee Convention. There's no point in making these unilateral stands like King Canute or somebody and saying Rwanda. Or whatever absurdity it is. We're going to stop the traffickers. You don't stop the traffickers. That's what people tried to do to drug pushers.
This is
nonsense. And new technology and new ideas will come along. The only way to deal with this is to recognize either we have a duty to the poorest and the neediest in our global society, or we don't. And if we don't, then we have to rethink the entire system, and that's too hard. So we need to recognize that we have that duty, and then we need to work out how we fulfill that duty. One way, I think, in terms of the refugees is to site consulates on the north shores of France and the north shores of the of Africa and in Turkey, so that people don't have to cross the Mediterranean or cross the Channel. We should ditch the idea that you can only claim asylum in the place where you're going. We should be able to anticipate that process. But the Henry Dimbleby thing, I think, is really wonderful, because this assumption that there's somebody who actively wants to, he's actively encouraging death. It's something. And I loved your reference to coprophage as well. Anyway, we're suddenly back on the farm and with a dog busy masticating his own fecal mess. But which sums up Kemi Badenoch, really, and so many others. But
not on a moist sandwich, mate. Not on a moist sandwich. Never
no,
on a moist sandwich.
She doesn't need a sandwich. She can just shove it in and be satisfied. She calls it steak. No. We mustn't underestimate steak. Steak's very important. I have a little bullock named after me. It's Suffolk, I think. I'm rather proud. Professor Tim is doing his job for society. But
I say then, it's interesting. Yeah, I agree. Blair did a lot of damage in the way that they brought in privatization as well. It's something you often forget.
They closed a lot of the smaller hospitals as well, the cottage hospitals.
Yeah, and getting rid of those was probably a terrible idea. It's sort of making it an industrialized process, so everything is under one roof because they get into their head.
It makes it an insurance process. Everything is now about money. So you say we shouldn't bring in insurance. The NHS is an insurance system, and people are making decisions based on how much it costs rather than how necessary something is. I've spent a huge amount of time in the last 2 years dealing with or listening to and trying to help and intercede about NHS whistleblowers, and everything is thrown at them, so that in the end the judicial system, the political system, the NHS system, so in the end these people become mad. I know a few completely crazy whistleblowers who had very good reasons for blowing them, and in fact they're told in their contract, they're told they have to blow the whistle if they see something wrong. They do it, and then they are chased through heaven and hell to the point where insanity hits, and that must be wrong. And the NHS spends so much money putting out fires which it has enkindled, that money should be spent on the patients. And we spend so much money. And one of the other things that I think people don't realise is how much money we spend on the wasteful bureaucrats in the NHS. NHS England, this huge building in the middle of London, is crowded with people who are paper pushing and don't know what they're doing.
It was Thatcher who brought in those changes. It started under Thatcher.
Yeah, I was going to point that out.
And actually, it was her affiliation with James Goldsmith, in fact, which really was, he was the sort of more quiet or the more under the radar influence of her back in those days. And again, it brings you back to this very wealthy, privileged, person that can trace their lineage back to God knows who, and who believes that they've got the answers to controlling society, which is always about the rich being free to do what the heck they like, and the poor lot, everyone else, should be controlled in some way. And that is exactly where we're headed now, with the sovereign individual thing.
I'm going to have to push back on the NHS. Hear me out on this. These two things, Tim. Come on. So the two things were, I've looked at the statistics recently to check and see what the management costs are for the NHS. And it's not necessarily the same thing as you're saying with the bureaucracy, but it's one of the lowest in the world. And compared to the American system, then it makes me wonder how much the bureaucracy, as much as it may be there, and it is necessary to an extent, is being embellished in papers to sort of undermine and undercut the NHS. Yeah. The other thing I'll say, and I've been trying to say it for a bit, 2014 to 2017, according to the Commonwealth Fund, I believe, they're saying that the NHS was number one in the world, or number two, over that period. It cannot be that bad, even though we've all had bad experiences, no doubt, compared to what the rest of the world's going through. And that's not to say we can't complain, criticize, or point out areas to improve. But I thought that was really interesting. Considering the cuts to austerity came in 2008, it was still punching well above its weight until COVID hit.
So it seems to be it. Alex, if you want to talk about efficiency, so America spends more on Medicare and Medicaid, which doesn't cover everyone, doesn't even cover a fraction of everyone. They spend more per capita on those two programs than we spend on the NHS in its entirety. So we're talking about value for money, but then you've got things like, and Liz is right, the winding down of the NHS started under Thatcher, but obviously the Labour government, 1997 to 2010, they brought in PFI, and one of the biggest mistakes they made in that, where they were bringing in this private partnerships, is that they gave service contracts to the private companies, which is still being fulfilled today. You're talking about like cleaners, you're talking about changing a light bulb will cost £200 in our hospital because they're just profiteering because they've got a contract that lasts for X many years and they're going to try and wring as much money out of it as possible. That needs to be looked at. Something Professor Tim mentioned there, which this should be on my Christmas wish list for Labour to look at, whistleblowing. So something that America does better than us is if you are involved in a class action lawsuit and you're a whistleblower for your company that you worked for or the NHS or whatever it is, you will get a cut of whatever the settlement is. So if a company that has polluted an entire city ends up having to pay billions, you'll get a cut of that. In the UK, you don't get that. You lose your job, you lose your place in that particular sector because no one's going to employ you because you're a whistleblower and there's no incentive to blow the whistle whatsoever. And when we talk about food security, big pharmaceuticals, things like that, where we might need someone to blow the whistle, everyone's scared to do it in this country because it'll mean they'll lose everything. They could lose their house, they could lose their family.
You've got to become a YouTuber.
Great. Not much money in that, though.
Graham, you mentioned PFI, which was Blair's contribution to improving the NHS. Look, if the NHS went so wrong under Thatcher, which I agree it did, I think slightly more under Major.
He brought in the management consultants. Major.
Blair had an opportunity to change all that, and he didn't. Yeah. There was quite a long period of Labour government. It didn't change that. If it was so wrong, why is it so obviously wrong now and not wrong then?
In 2010, the NHS was found to be the best healthcare system in the world. And I suppose it's a bit like what Winston Churchill supposedly said about democracy. It's the worst system, but it's the best we got. It's apart from all the others. Is it the worst one, except for all the others? And I look at some other countries, like in Australia, you need an ambulance insurance. And I've been at an accident where someone has said, please do not call me an ambulance. I don't have insurance. I can't afford to be picked up by an ambulance after being in a car crash and literally bleeding on the floor. And so I've had to stuff them into a taxi because they could afford $20 for a taxi. They couldn't afford the $3,000 they'd have to pay to get to the hospital in an ambulance. I don't want that system. And look at other systems around the world. And it's just... yeah, the NHS is not perfect, and I'd like it to be better. And I think there are ways of making it better, and Starmer definitely has an opportunity right now to do that with his massive majority in the Commons. Whether he does that, grasps the nettle, makes it world class again.
He's not going to, Graham. He's not going to. They're in bed.
You've stolen the punchline.
Sorry.
That's all right. But yeah,
I can't imagine. With a Conservative government led by Kemi Badenoch, he's going to be goaded into doing anything that he might not want to do.
Mm.
It's rather sad. We have the worst of both worlds. And I despair each Wednesday when I listen to Prime Minister's questions. I think, it's not about tribalism. It's about holding the government to account. And it doesn't matter who does it. Even if Mr. Farage were to stand up and do it, at least somebody would. Instead, we have somebody wittering and Keir Starmer not even bothering to answer any of the questions. It's disturbing. Keir Starmer was never any good in front of a jury. He's extremely analytical and extremely good on his own, but he's there playing to his weakness, and he's in front of somebody who is a gibbering idiot.
Well,
talking about sandwiches.
Tim, I did have the opportunity to speak. I was on Nigel Farage's show on Wednesday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
look, I'll put this in. I really don't mind speaking to Nigel.
He's a darling in face-to-face.
As a person, he's actually very easy to talk to.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with him as a person. But I don't agree with his politics. But it doesn't mean to say that you... And I'm not somebody that needs to speak with people who all agree with me. I like being challenged by somebody who doesn't agree with me. And we should all do that. That's healthy.
Absolutely.
That's healthy debate.
No, we shouldn't.
So I don't mind talking. I find it quite invigorating talking to Nigel. We have a good chat. But Ranall, who was the briefest DEFRA secretary ever, Conservative MP who lost his seat under Liz Truss. He was DEFRA secretary, was on the panel. I think he was a MP down in Sussex. I can't remember his surname now. But we had a little chat in the green room, and I was being a bit naughty, as I normally am. And I said, so when are you going to get rid of Kemi then? Because, let's be honest, no one's going to vote for her. I said, they certainly won't be voting for her in my area. There's absolutely no way. And he sort of tried to do all this thing. And I said, come on, it's off the record. I won't tell anyone. Here I am. Telling everyone.
What did he say?
He said, well, who else would you have?
Well, that is a good question.
And I said, that's difficult. That is difficult. I said, probably the best person you would have would be to try and get Rory Stewart back. And he said,
Oh, God, yes.
They said, no, they would never forgive him because he's been unfaithful and been critical of the party. So we both said, the Ollie who was with me said, well, you need to come back. If you want to win votes, you've got to come back to the centre. And he sort of looked at us like this. And I said, well, probably the best person just about is Penny Mordaunt. I mean, you're going to get more votes from my area with someone like Penny Mordaunt. And I'm not saying she's perfect, but she's better than Kemi Badenoch or any of the others. I mean, Robert Jenrick, for goodness sake.
I'm quite happy for the Tories to have a terrible leader. Thank you very much.
No, Graham, you're wrong.
I don't agree with you, Graham.
It makes no difference.
When
terrible
Labour
leaders for the last
Corbyn, it was
10
a
years.
Disaster. We need good opposition.
Yes!
You've got to have strength and democracy on both sides.
I'd much prefer it was the Liberal Democrats. We can move the Overton window.
Davey's absolutely hopeless. Tim Farron is a million times better than Ed Davey.
Oh, the person who is superb is Stephen Flynn. I mean, you just yes. long for the moment yeah. when he stands up and speaks without notes.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Mind you, I was slightly disturbed when Robert Jenrick stood up and spoke for about 20 minutes without notes. I thought, a rival, somebody can actually do it. But I mean, listening to the content, I was more disturbed. But
don't you think, like, that Labour get held to account by literally everyone, not just members of Labour who all spend most of the time arguing amongst themselves, but also the newspapers who absolutely hate Starmer and the whole party and everything he stands for? Then you've got the people on the hard left who absolutely hate Starmer and everything he stands for.
I don't agree with you, Graham. I think that the right-wing press wants us to be divided, and I think they know what to say to jingle the bells for one tribe and jingle the bells for another. And I know that I'm actually immune to it. I'm able to look at it. I'm able to read lots of different articles and not get sucked into it. That's why you need to read all of the newspapers, not just one newspaper, because they've all got a bias. And so you've got to be able to read across the board and ask questions. Why are they saying this? And that's what I do.
I'm not old enough to read newspapers. Sorry, Liz. I'm just on Snapchat.
Graham, the other thing is we elect people into Parliament to do that job. If they can't do the job, then the newspapers are going to do it, or YouTube is going to do it. We're going to do it. But we really should have a government and an opposition that is actually doing that job. Otherwise, there is no point in having a Parliament. We elect people to represent us in Parliament. If they can't do that job, they need to clear off and find somebody else who can do it in their place.
It's a puppet show at the moment. It's Punch and Judy puppet show.
And they're reading from
scripts. It always has been Punch and Judy. I mean, Punch magazine was invented to talk about Parliament back in the 1800s.
I think PMQs is just not up to scratch for what it needs to be.
Putting TV cameras in there is probably the worst.
What you'll get out of it is good clips. And I think the concern I've got is that if you've got a weak opposition and it's the Conservatives, does that galvanise reforms base more because Kemi's so useless?
What we really want
is a sort of split, which is something we haven't had on the right for a long, long time.
Yes. I was about to say this because Liz mentioned splits on the left, right? The NHS really does divide, and then versus a private healthcare system, it does divide the right. It's one of the few issues that divides them, along with animal rights. Those two things, we
and
can
the
use them as pressure points, because there are people on the right who are very, very pro animal rights, and there's people on the left, on the right, who just want to torture animals to death.
So why on Wednesday when the tractors were parked outside Parliament, did Kemi Badenoch not say a word?
She went on about immigration.
Immigration, the subject.
Someone gave her a soggy sandwich, Tim. She was traumatized from the soggy sandwich that someone gave her.
Soggy sandwich.
It was too moist.
Is that a bit like the biscuit game?
No, God no. Well, I don't know. I didn't go to her school, but the fact that the Tories are so weak at the moment, I just think, oh, good, because I'm sick of seeing their stupid faces every day. I'm sick of them setting the agenda, setting the narrative that we all have to react to. Oh, what crazy thing have the Conservatives done or said today? Oh, we're going to have to make a video about that. I would much rather constructive criticism. And if we talk about Punch and Judy politics, that's British politics. If we want that to change, it's got nothing to do with the leaders. We've got to change the very geography of our political system. We have a Punch and Judy show because we have a parliament that sits opposite each other and screams obscenities at each other each week. Whereas every other parliament in the world is a circular thing where people get together and they talk about
Absolutely.
A common way forward, which we never do.
Because they're continually playing Tom and Jerry with each other. Yeah.
Well, they do a little bit more in the House of Lords, but now we're getting rid of the hereditary peers. That is going to stop because they were the people who produced some of the most interesting arguments. I love the debates in the House of Lords, but now the House of Lords is going to be literally staffed with cronies.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, let's be honest, it already is. There's only 98 that are hereditary. And then you've got
they pulled their weight.
But is there the 12? Isn't there also the 12 ecclesiastical lords as well?
The 26.
Is that the only country
27 or 26, and the Archbishop of Canterbury has shown how absurd that is with his another person who witters. He does it without notes, incidentally.
What's the other country that's actually got people from the clergy Iran. Automatically in the legislature?
Iran.
Right.
What do you think?
It's called a theocracy.
On. Touched on it. What did you think of Kemi Badenoch's attack on the sandwich, a British invention?
I prefer not to comment. I think of my future as Professor Tim the Bullock. I'm looking forward to filling that sandwich one day.
Oh my! Yeah, she has the opportunity to do an interview in the Spectator magazine, a friendly magazine, with Michael Gove, one of the people who promoted her in the first place, an old Bezzy mate from the Tory days, and softball interview, and she goes off on what about sandwiches and not doing lunch unless someone brings her a steak. It's just bizarre.
But she says she does it because she said she didn't have time for lunch, didn't she? And that lunch is for wimps, as if that makes her hard. But the irony is the reason for the sandwich to be invented was to save time. That was the whole point. You're just like, oh my God.
I think she's trying
quicker to eat than a sandwich.
I think she's trying to challenge the idea that she's lazy and she's taken a leaf, literally a leaf, out of the book of Liz Truss. Liz Truss is the person who famously said that she wanted all her information on a piece of A4 in quite bold type. So she didn't want to read a book. And I think Kemi Badenoch does the same thing. She's looked to Liz Truss as her inspiration. I don't think she's right. Liz Truss is represented by a vegetable. And I think, you know, lettuce. Now we've got a cabbage.
And you're the bull, Tim, and you're the bull.
That was the fun cover of the Private Eye a few weeks ago, wasn't it? She's the new Lady T, and then someone says Truss.
Oh wow!
It is very, very depressing. I don't know what the answer is. They're all useless. I think that things are going to continue to get worse, and I think the Labour Party, I did want them to have a large majority because I thought that they might use it to try and get back into Europe, but I got that one wrong. And
you have to vote for Rejoin.
Yeah.
I know, Alex and I will tell you all about it.
I think it's going to get very interesting very fast next year with Trump in America, because if he goes the way he wants to and starts imposing tariffs on everything, we are going to have to go into the outer orbit of Europe at the very least, because otherwise our nation's going to go bankrupt.
Do you know that Keir Starmer and Steve Reed, the Defra Secretary, he came into office, Steve Reed, and he said that he pledged that farmers would never be at the mercy of another awful Tory trade deal. But there's a judicial review against this, the Australia trade deal, because they never did an impact assessment on the environment, the environmental impact of that, which we all know is going to be abysmal.
Yes.
And this non-government association feedback have got this JR, which has been in the pipeline for 2 years. Steve Reed has taken it upon himself to challenge their right to a cost capping order, which was awarded to them under the Conservative government. They didn't challenge it, but Steve Reed is. So that is how aggressively they're defending Brexit. Wow. And that is when I woke up to the fact that they are not looking to get back to the EU. They're not looking to get a veterinary agreement. To get a veterinary agreement, they've got to give all assurances to Europe that we will manage our borders. There's absolutely no way they can manage the internal borders here. So it's all just noise, which means nothing. And all I see is a preparation for some sort of American trade deal, whether it's a direct trade deal or whether it's that America eventually joins CPTPP. If you look at the uptick in imports from Brazil since Brexit, it's frightening. The quotas of the EU deal with Mercosur are minimal. They're nothing. They're like a burger and a half per capita. And, you know, what we have got coming in from Brazil alone at the moment is terrifying. And they are doing nothing about stopping that. So I have very little confidence in this Labour leadership. I just hope that the Labour for EU group, Stella Creasy, get their act together and do something about it.
How did you respond to the trade deal that came in to the EU from the whole of South? It's the whole of South.
That's America. The Mercosur deal, yeah.
Yes.
As I said, it's been in negotiation for 22 years.
So it's partly free trade deal, isn't it? It's not fully free trade. But the thing that caught my eye was the reaction within the UK being concerned about now South America importing goods, but the UK not, and then the border being an open access area.
There's been a lot of reaction. Thank goodness we're not in the EU anymore. The Brexiteers being said, because we would have to, you know, put up with that bad deal. Like, that deal is a very good deal compared to what we've signed away with Australia. And like I said, even under WTO, we have got huge amounts of meat, chicken especially, coming in from Brazil, and beef, which we've reduced the checks on as well. So it's an absolute nonsense that it's bad for us. What will happen is that the displaced EU meat will probably end up, more of it will probably end up flooding in here and undercutting our British farmers. So we decided to leave the EU, and we're a little raft on the outside of it. And every time the EU makes a decision, we just sort of like slapped another wave, you know, because we cannot move physically where we are. So we are always going to be worse off where we are in Brexit. Even with an America trade deal, it's not going to work, because we're just going to end up being a sort of poor relative of everybody.
And with our open border with Ireland, it's not just Brexit, which I think might be a problem. I personally think it is, but I'm prepared to concede it may not have been. But the implementation of Brexit by people who didn't look at who didn't do their homework has left us with a mess in Northern Ireland, a mess in the Channel, a gaping mess across the two industries which were supposed to benefit most from Brexit, farming and fishing, were the two industries which have been most slaughtered by Brexit.
Now, and immigration was meant to be improved.
Oh, yes. But people were
fearful of it, yeah.
I was going to go back and say about farming. It was George Eustace who really messed up farming at the beginning of the Conservative period implementing stuff from Europe that stopped these casual workers coming over and working for a short period of time. This killed off, for example, the bulb industry in Lincolnshire, because you can't employ people on a long-term basis when you've only got to employ them for 2 days in the year, and so on. It's been one hit after another for farming and for fishing, and simply because Lord Frost and Co., the stupidity not to be able to negotiate a replacement for the Dublin Protocol, not to be able to negotiate a decent agreement for the Northern Ireland border, recognising these things and assuming that all this will work well, and delaying doing the Brexit agreement until Europe had got all its soldiers in place to make it the worst of all possible agreements.
But Lord Frost
cannot now work.
Lord Frost has been very critical of the deal that was negotiated by Lord Frost.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, but hindsight.
What a time to be alive.
Hindsight is great fun.
What worries me about the potential of an American trade deal, an American trade deal with Trump, so it would be incredibly one-sided towards the Americans, is that a fundamental difference between the way we do things in Europe and the way they do things in America is this. If you want to sell a product in Europe, generally speaking, you have to prove that it's safe before you can sell it. It's why GM crops are still banned in the EU. In the US, you can put anything to market and you're all right until someone dies.
Yeah.
And then they might consider a ban on it. And it's like, oh my God, that's the way you do it. Yeah, you know, the market will find the way. You know, the market will light the way. And I'm like, I don't want that. I don't want, you know, our food in this country to be flooded with cheap, bad imports.
It already is, Graham. Yeah. It's very bad as it is.
And that takes us back, Liz, to what we were talking about, the NHS, because it puts more strain on the NHS because we're eating crap food.
And
we're
all I'm getting at the moment, especially from people on the left, is they're saying farmers should pay inheritance tax. Oh. And it's driving me nuts.
Yes.
You know, Because that is the straw that's breaking the camel's back. And then you end up with a whole load of Cargill factories where the farms were, which is low standards, hormones and chemicals that are banned in the EU, and GM crops will suddenly get in here and will never rejoin the EU. This is what I'm trying to explain to people. You think I don't like that farmer in that green jacket and that flat cap. Well, I can tell you now, you won't like the owner of bloody Cargill, the same as you go back to the owner of that healthcare company who was killed recently. It's the same bloody thing.
Would you support it if the upper limit was higher? Because what do you do in situations where multimillionaires buy up farmland just to avoid tax?
I believe in universalism. The problem actually is not to do with the inheritance. The rich people don't pay inheritance tax because they've all got their land in trust. So the inheritance tax on farms doesn't change that. We rent some land off a wealthy family who've had it in trust for hundreds of years.
Right.
It's not going anywhere.
So James Dyson's kids aren't going to have to pay any inheritance tax.
As long as he lives long enough.
He will have it in trust.
Right, so there'll be another loophole.
And in fairness, the one thing I will say about Dyson is at least he's farming it and producing food and he's doing it sustainably and he's trying to bring innovation into it. It isn't the best investment. The reason that land is so expensive is that investors are buying land. We had somebody recently buy land near us off Thames Water. Then they get an option agreement with a building company. They paid £600,000 for it and they're about to be weighed out with millions and millions of pounds because they've got a housing contract. This is what's going on. Then there's a rollover thing, which actually they could change. They can roll over all of that money into more land and then they don't have to pay any tax on it. And they haven't, this government haven't done anything about that. They've come for the inheritance tax on farms because they're committed to the factory farming with Cargill.
My biggest concern is the factory farming element. And if I was searching around to see if there was a policy that was targeting a group as specifically as farming in any other way, and I couldn't see it. Well, I think one of the most interesting things that I've heard, though, is, well, why should farmers be protected? Why not doctors and police officers and other people that have that? And I was sort of thinking to myself, maybe they should be protected as well.
No, but it's
maybe
not, that, Alex, but, you've got but, it wrong. No, it's no, not the no, farmer no, no, that's protected.
It's the land.
I hadn't finished. I liked your idea of if 80% of the farmland is used for farming instead of this trust fund or anything else. That seems to make more sense for that to have the exemption inside of that.
Personally, think inheritance tax is a bad tax. Only 4% of the population pay it, and it tends to be pushed onto the actual middle lot who can't afford the professional advice to avoid it. I think it's a rubbish tax. Keir Starmer could have gone after the LLPs who've got a tax loophole for lawyers and architects and so forth, which costs the Treasury billions a year. But he didn't go after that. He's decided to go after the farmers. And everybody likes to hate farmers in this country. Not everybody, but a certain type of person thinks that farmers are all to blame. As I said, the exemption on inheritance tax is about food production, and it's also with BPR, that, you know, for small and medium-sized businesses, they're impacted as well. It's to do with keeping the economy going, and it's to stop monopolisation. It's to stop big corporations buying family-owned businesses, of which farms are that. So if you're backing the inheritance tax, you're backing big corporations, monopolisation, Americanization. It's that simple.
Absolutely. The other thing I would say about the farming and about the objections to about the support of the inheritance tax is people say, oh, the farmers are elite, the farmers are rich. Again, it's not about the farmers, it's about the land. And we have to look back at our history, at the land army, at the fact that farming is the backbone of Britain. We take away farming and we've already got very little left. Our education is being destroyed.
I think it's 70 or 80%.
Farming is being destroyed. And what do we have? Are we going to start exporting our wonderful politics?
I think we already did that, didn't we?
No. We're importing it, unfortunately. And But you know, and Keir Starmer, Liz, so brilliant. You point out there's a possibility that Keir Starmer could have attacked the legal profession. I wonder why he doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they went after non-doms. They put VAT on private school fees. There's a few other groups that they went after.
Let's just go on.
And they put national insurance up for employers.
Graham, could I just pick up the private school fees, because there's a link between the private school fees and the farm and the inheritance tax on the farms, because it's not about whether this tax is good or bad. Let's say for a moment that both taxes, both the inheritance tax and the private and the VAT, are good, but to impose both with this sort of knee-jerk decision that's going to happen almost immediately, when farming is a long-term process, when schooling is a long-term process, what you're going to end up with is people who are desperate. The inheritance tax could well literally kill off farmers. And the VAT is already closing schools. Now, if we go to the Treasury assured us that the VAT would not close small faith schools, like, for example, Emmanuel College or Emmanuel Primary School in North London. It has. And the Treasury has assured us the farm tax will not close small family farms.
I thought that particular school closed before the VAT came in.
Of course it has. It's closed because it's not going to be able to afford the VAT plus the national insurance. Plus, I think there's something else. I forget what it is. It's a triple whammy that smaller schools cannot pay. And the idea behind both is that it's elite farmers and elite rich children who go to these schools. It's not true.
Politics. They're lying.
Well, I've got to say, I've never met a lad from a sink estate in Bootle who went to Harvard, Harrow or Eton or Winchester.
Less than
1% of the kids who go to those schools get a full bursary.
I'm so sorry, Graham. You haven't looked. I had a full bursary at the school that I went to.
Yeah,
and not because I asked.
You were part of the 1%. That they need to,
I've also taught in private schools and state schools, and I've taught in schools abroad. And you don't necessarily get a better education in a private school, but you do.
How come everyone on TV went to private school? Literally,
it simply isn't.
I can watch TV all day, and every single one of those people I see on TV went to private school.
It simply isn't true.
There's privateschoolmafia.com. Have a look. There's a list.
Okay. We'll produce that list. I haven't seen that list, but it isn't true.
The 93% of us who went to state schools feel like, you know, with some justification, that if we want to get a job in a profession that isn't just, you know, the service industry, then we're up against it. We have to be incredibly talented or incredibly lucky or a bit of both.
Because the school system is failing us.
Exactly, that's the problem. I think if you want to get rid of private schools and have all state schools, you've got to improve the state schools so that you don't need them. And I think this culture war that has been unleashed, and there's several, there's the Winterfuel Allowance, there's the private school VAT, and there's the farmers. All three are designed, the politics of envy, culture war, to cause division, when actually we all agree, because we all started out and we all agree with universalism here and fairness. And in the great scheme of things, you know, I was privately educated, but I sent my children to a state school until my son was attacked by a gang with a hammer. But the truth of the matter is that I am a liberal, and I do believe that if somebody has a child who needs special needs and there is a private school that's offering the opportunity for them to have one-on-one, they should be allowed to pay for that. I think that that's fine. The elitism of Eton and Harrow is not going to change because of Keir Starmer's VAT on schools. That will continue because the very, very wealthy can still afford to pay the VAT on those school fees. So again, this policy sounds good, but it actually attacks the middle aspirational vote. Or, you know, I spoke to, when I was, I sound like such a bloody celebrity here. I was in Sky this week because of my tractor rally with Beth Rigby. And the makeup artist is working 3 days a week. And she's got a nephew who's got real special needs. And he's had to come out and leave that school. And it's really having fundamental problems on him because they can't afford the school fees. So I think it really is a war on the middle class, actually, rather than on the elite and the wealthy. But it triggers people that want to be angry with the wealthy. And so they sort of think, yeah, I like this. Keir Starmer's doing what I want him to.
Yeah. So many send students have not been properly diagnosed. It takes 2 years to diagnose
at least
somebody.
Yeah.
But these are fundamental problems with the state school system, which I believe are exacerbated by the fact that the rich get to take their kids out of that system and therefore have no vested interest in that system working whatsoever. And we have the schools around here, you know, doing a jumble sale to raise a couple hundred quid, you know, so they can heat the rooms for a day.
But that's not the case. But
meanwhile, Joe would really help having just one millionaire on the PTA. That would really, really help.
I was brought up in the private sector. I've taught in private and state sector. And I even worked as an online consultant. So I've done quite a bit within the education system. And I would personally scrap the whole thing because, in my opinion, it commodifies people's education. And the things that you've brought up are things that I've seen. So I've worked in private state schools where you've got SEN children who have zero support. Mm-hmm. And you then go, why is this not funded correctly? Why are they not being supported? Why are these kids being left in some cases, not all, because there's loads of good teachers out there, in a ditch and ignored and treated badly? And I end up going, why can we not just go with the Finnish model? And I think there's so many systemic things within the education system that are abhorrent, and it's down to funding and attitude, but also the system and the way it's set up. So I'd scrap league tables.
I agree with that. I would have them for LEAs overall, for LEAs, but not for individual schools.
It's always the unintended consequences that it sounds nice, but actually to rush this through without probably doing proper analysis of how it's going to impact, they should have actually. We've gone through years of austerity. We've had years of Brexit straining the life out of everything. Mm. And to then bring in this change now is not helping. It's a political decision based on ideology, not on actually making sure our education system is better.
I think the ideology in the long term is to basically get rid of it if he has enough time.
But it's not going to get rid of it, is it? Because Harrow and Eton and all of the expensive schools are still going to remain.
Yeah, but I still said it was the beginning of it. I never said it was like, it's not like one of those first little steps that you can do to erode it. And I think there is a justification for it. We've all brought up that we like the NHS because it's universal and it means you turn up and you get a good quality of healthcare. I don't see what the difference is within education. And it almost, like, having gone through that system, all I see is through majority of the schools, people will argue that this, no doubt in the chat, all I see is that you become a commodity. And it's all about your grades. And if your grades aren't good enough, you're kicked out. And there's no reason for you to be there. You are literally seen as a commodity. It's not about your education. Now, I'm not saying that the teachers inside of there look at it in the same way. I have no doubt the teachers in those private schools are looking at this and going, I want to make that kid as good as they can possibly be. But the actual system itself is wrong. And it's no different to me as the NHS is. Like, I'm sure there should be lots of private businesses out there. They do a lot of good work and everything else. But in certain sectors, I just don't see the benefit of it. In fact, I'll say this. Every single private school I went to, we never played a state school. There is a cultural gap between the groups that is created within that. Uniforms as well does the exact same thing. It creates a culture of us and them. And I see that all the way through. And then you get these idiots coming through who then run these high regulated positions, such as politics or the media. And then they suppress everyone else. And they've got this huge chunk of the population going. We don't get social mobility.
What I would say, the problem...
There's no social mobility in this country.
Is that you're making an argument for having a more of a sort of Scandinavian better education system, which I totally agree with you. But what we've got is a shock to our education system by a very political decision to target a certain type of private school, which is going to have an impact on the state sector, because the people who are just about managing to afford to send their kids to those schools are now going to have to send them to a state school, which is still struggling because they haven't got enough money to run everything.
You go back to what Graham said, which was, wouldn't it be nice to have a millionaire on the board? So wouldn't it be nice to have someone who's got a bit of extra cash they can pump in? The example I'll give was when I was working in the States, you didn't have this. Private schools at that point didn't really exist. And one of the most amazing things I ever saw was that the poorest kid in the school, who was an absolute troublemaker, was hanging out with one of the richest kids in the school. And then on top of that, the dad, the two kids played soccer together, football for the English, soccer over there. And the dad was donating huge sums of money to the soccer team in order for them to have the equipment that they needed, to have the PA system that they wanted. Obviously, it's a different attitude over there than what we get here.
So you're arguing now for the David Cameron charity giving.
No, I'm not, I am definitely
of the universalism. I think the state should run things. I think the state should pay for stuff. I think we should put, when people say it's costing a fortune for services, it doesn't really, because it's a circular economy. The money goes in and it's spent and it keeps everything going locally. It only costs money if it's going out of the country. So I think we've been brainwashed into believing that we can't afford things, particularly since austerity. And that is because they want to go more towards more of an American system. Yeah. But I would say in my boarding school, we did have kids who were there on bursaries, who had different backgrounds. And we were definitely encouraged to play with the state schools as well. So I don't think there is a generalized thing. And it was definitely a very liberal school that I went to.
Liz, my experience has really been that we live in a very, very two-tier system. And it just depends whether you went to private school or not. It's not what you know. It's not even who you know. It's what you know about who you know. And if you went to boarding school with them, you probably know them a bit better than I do. And having those introductions for you as a teenager gets you so far in life. And it's why every single Oscar winner for the last 40 years from Britain has been privately educated.
I grew up calling bingo to Welsh miners. I come from a travelling fairground background. My parents were aspirational. The education system in South Wales, where I grew up, was appalling. And they made the decision because of their lifestyle to send me to boarding school because, you know, it was a pain in the neck having kids.
But were my parents not aspirational? I went to the best school in Liverpool.
I'm not saying
we had one lad in our year got into Oxford.
Let me finish. I would have been, when I was at school and I was terribly homesick, I was jealous of you being at home with your mum. And it isn't quite as straightforward as, and you're not necessarily as lucky. You become different because you're sent to boarding school from a young age and you have to learn to survive. And that is, makes you a different person to the kid that stays at home. My kids stayed at home with me because of the experience that I had. So it doesn't mean to say that one is right or one is wrong. We all have a different experience.
You're not really selling it to me.
Could I ask
and as a safeguarding point, they don't have to be inspected by Ofsted. They don't have to follow the national curriculum. No, they don't have to.
Yes,
they can choose to, but they do not have to.
But they don't have to by law.
By law, they don't. And you don't have to be qualified as a teacher
to teach them. Want them to be...
Go on, Tim.
Can I ask one other question?
We're going to have
to wrap up. What would you do with homeschooling? Would that be out of the question?
Yes, absolutely. 100%. No, just no. Because, look, if you have an Ofsted inspection in everyone's house who wants to homeschool, yes, fair enough. But again, it's a safeguarding issue. I could see people who have children who want to abuse those children. And if they don't get out the house and go and meet any other children, it's a safeguarding issue for me. So, I wouldn't have homeschooling.
Brilliant.
I wouldn't have private schools. I would do what they do in Finland, where they actually not just made private schools against the law, they made them unconstitutional.
All right. I think everybody's an individual, and I know people that have homeschooled their kids. And God, I had my kids at home for a year after my son was attacked, and I had to homeschool them because my son had a serious brain injury. So I think it's really hard to have a system which works across the board because every situation is individual. I think that we need to be more liberal about this. I'm not completely in terms of saying one size fits all. But I think the problem we've got with this particular VAT thing is it sparked this culture war, which we're now discussing, instead of actually saying we're going to invest in our schools and make them better and make the education better. And that is what should be done, so that private schools perhaps don't, we don't need so many of them, because the key to getting rid of them, as I said, and the key to getting rid of private hospitals is making sure that the health system is better for everybody. And then you don't want to spend your money on a private system because the state system's great. That's the answer to it, not penalising people who've made the decision to do something else.
I'm going to have to end there. Thank you very much to the team. We're a team now, which is pretty damn cool. Sunday Rose team. These guys are all co-hosts. So thank you so much for coming on. We're going to have a different format into the new year. Thank you so much, everyone. If you want to check them out, the link's in the description. Once again, if you enjoyed this, I assume you did by getting this far, hit that like and subscribe button. Thank you very much, everyone. Hail to the lamp.
Thank you.
Hail to the lamp. Hail to the lamp.
Another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
Santa Claus is unavailable. Who do you pick to replace him? Graham, Nigel Farage, Kemi Badenoch, or Priti Patel?
Oh my God. They're all horrible. I would pick Priti Patel because I don't think me or Nigel Farage have. I don't want to give them the platform. I don't want them to be any more on the TV or on the radio or on news sites than they already are.
You would like Priti Patel whizzing over the top of you, screaming over the reindeer.
Oh my word. It would be like the Nightmare Before Christmas, wouldn't it? You'd open the box and there'd be like a severed head inside it. You'd be like, this is Halloween. This is.
Rwanda is coming.
Why are you doing that?
At least you'd be very good with the list, wouldn't it? Who's on my naughty list?
Naughty list. Off to Rwanda with you.
Professor Tim.
Oh gosh.
Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, or Rishi Sunak?
Well, I've always had a soft spot for Rishi Sunak. Jacob Rees-Mogg will at least bring some sort of Catholicism and some sort of religious context to Christmas, wouldn't it? But I think we'd have to go. I think it's like call my bluff, isn't it? I think we'd have who's giving the true answer. I think we'd have to go for Boris Johnson because he would at least put the merry into Christmas, and we'd be able to compare hairstyle. Boris, happy Christmas. There we are.
Liz,
I'm ready.
Vladimir Putin.
Ooh.
Assad.
Ooh.
Or Trump.
Oh, well, can't be Vladimir Putin. I mean, that's just terrifying.
He would be laced with polonium.
The Santa suit would be too big and it would fall off him. He's too small.
Surprise, Novichok.
And Assad would just be too. He just looks all wrong to be Santa. So it's going to have to be Trumpy, baby.
Don't want him coming down the chimney.
All of them would have access for that night to be able to go into everyone's house.
I'm going to leave the fire burning.
On that note, Merry Christmas. Bye, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
Bye. Merry Christmas. Lots of love.